My name is Rick Taylor. I'm sorry I haven't been in here more to before now to meet you all and get to know you better and everything, but hopefully I'll be in here today. I'll be in here next Wednesday morning as well with you. And last year I taught Acts and Romans, but I asked Jeff if he'd do Acts this year, and it sounds like he's doing a great job and everything. So I'm glad about that for you. Is everybody here?
I believe so.
Do you have buddies or?
We do.
Okay. So everybody's here? Okay, very good. Would a couple of you pray for our time together? A couple of you willing to volunteer and do that? Okay, one. Anybody else? Okay, great. Let's pray.
Lord, thank you for another morning that you've blessed for us, Lord, for a chance to study some of the history and some more kind of geographical areas, Lord, that will help us put the stories and the things that we're learning in the Old Testament here into context and hopefully help us gain a greater understanding. Lord, I pray that you speak through your Spirit to us this morning and continue to reveal the truths that you've already been revealing to us, Lord.
Father, just thanks for another morning, God, another chance to worship you today. And just pray for this time that we would just be looking into your word and looking into more about who you are, God, and that you would just reveal more of yourself to us. That we would be receptive to everything that we learn, and just pray that we would just honor you throughout this day and throughout this morning.
Amen. A few years ago, I had the privilege of spending an entire summer, 3 months, doing nothing but studying on what I'm going to be talking about today. Okay? And so I, full-time for 3 months, just reading and researching this area. I'm not an expert, but I learned a lot in those 3 months that have helped me understand my Old Testament a whole lot better, especially what you're studying with Mike right now in terms of the book of Genesis, the whole Pentateuch, some of the history and culture that's behind the story of the Bible. And it has really opened up a lot of things for me. It also helped me, first time I went to Israel, to appreciate and see some things through a different lens than I ever had before, and maybe I can share a couple of those things with you today that will be helpful when you guys go as well. But we have this handout. We're just going to walk through it. We won't cover every single thing in here. Probably need about twice as much time to do that, but I think we can get all the really important stuff that would be helpful as we do that. What we're going to be talking about at the top of the page, there is the land of Sumer, the Sumerians, and then beyond that. But what is that? What we're going to be talking about is the land, the place, the culture that Abraham was called out of as a man of 75 years of age to go to a land that God would show him. Now, you all have gotten through, you're into the life of Abraham. Are you through with the life of Abraham?
Last week we just finished.
You got to 25? Okay.
Sarah had just died.
Okay. So you've seen a lot of the life of Abraham right now. Hopefully some of the stuff we'll look at today will help you understand some of the reasons why they did some of the things they did. You scratch your head and say, why did you do that, you dummy? That doesn't make any sense. But when you understand the culture that Abraham and Sarah came out of, it makes a lot more sense why they did some of the things they did and the way that they did them as well. It helps you understand how they were able to do to accomplish certain things that don't make a lot of sense. So we're going to talk a little bit about, in the flow of things, some of the things that are going to make a lot more sense is why in the world did Abraham's wife Sarah recommend that he marry her handmaid and have a baby? by him, and why did he so readily agree to do that and not hesitate a whole lot? How in the world did Abraham take his servants and go east and conquer four kings and their armies that had gone into Sodom and Gomorrah and taken away Lot and his family and a lot of other people? How in the world did Abraham have the wherewithal to be able to do that with his household servants and everything? Well, we can say, well, that was miraculous, that God can do anything. And that's true, but there's more to the story than just that as well. How did Abraham know to plant certain kinds of vegetation in a wilderness, in a desert that you're going to go visit, and not to plant other things? How did he know that? All of those things we're going to look at, sort of the background behind those and a lot of other things that help make more sense of his life. Okay? So let's begin looking at this map on the first place, on the first page there. And I'm going to take just a few minutes to go through this to look at it. So if you'll notice on this map, in the northwest corner, if I can just point that out, the top left-hand corner, there is Akkad. Maybe you've heard of the Akkadians described before. That is where they are from. Look down below that is Sumer. That's southern modern-day Iraq. Akkad would be northern Iraq and southern some portions of southern Turkey. And then Elam to the east of that, on the right side of that map. Those three areas, if you'll notice the type on those is larger and the same, those are three regions of what's known as Mesopotamia. Akkad to the north, Sumer in the south, which is mostly Iraq, Elam to the east, which is mostly modern-day Iran, at least western Iran. Those three regions were descendants of Shem. So Abraham was a descendant of Shem. These areas were descendants of Shem. Shem himself settled in what is called Sumer there, but some of his descendants spread beyond that as well. We'll look at where Ham and Japheth went, the other two sons of Noah, after the flood. But this is where he settled. And this is really, from all that we can tell historically, the birthplace of modern-day civilization. After the flood, this is the place where modern civilization spread from. If you look at the bottom right-hand corner of that map, you'll see a dotted line that says ancient coastline. That was the Persian Gulf before a few thousand years of silt has washed down through the Tigris-Euphrates River and filled it in. Very similar to what's happening in Louisiana today in the Mississippi Delta area, where the Mississippi River for hundreds of years now that America has been here has been washing down into that area, and it's they're having to dredge it and do everything else to keep it open, because the natural drift is for the stuff from up north to drift down and settle there in that low area just before it goes out into the ocean. And it can fill up with silt and sand and not be passable anymore. And that's what happened here. So if you'll look at that dotted line, you'll find Ur, just U-R. See that? That, from all that we can tell, used to be a coastal city. It's not today. Ur is still there today in modern-day Iraq. But much of what is down there in that filled-in area didn't used to be there. It just used to be the Persian Gulf. And Ur was a coastal city. And that is the city that Abraham is from. Looks like just a little dot, like all the rest of the little dots on there that are cities and all that. But we're going to talk a little bit more about that, because during the day of Abraham, that was the city. In all the area we're looking at here, that was the most important city in the world at that time. All of these cities that you see on this map date back before 3000 BC. We have historical records of events and places and kings, all kinds of things, going back 3,000 years before the time of Abraham. I shouldn't say that. 3,000 BC, let's put it that way. Mesopotamia, which I said is this whole area, simply means between the rivers. So you can see the Tigris and Euphrates River on the southwest part, and the Euphrates River, and the Tigris runs closer to modern-day Iran on the northeast part of that map a little bit. And that's all that Mesopotamia means, is between the rivers. Now, it gets to be 120 degrees there. The climate there is very similar to the Central Valley. It's basically a desert that has a couple of rivers, that major rivers that run through it. They only get 2 to 10 inches of rain a year. In the summertime, it's very hot. The winters are very similar to our winter here, very short, a little moisture, and that's what you get for most of the year, and you have to live on it for the whole year. They do have mountains to the east that they benefit from, just as we do here, the Sierra Mountains, but most of it has to do with the rivers that run through and how they are able to conserve the little bit of water that they do get every year. And we'll talk more about that in just a second. The Akkad people up above during the days of Abraham, and the Elam people to the east, were very aggressive compared to the Sumerians. The people from Sumer were much more educated, refined, skillful people. They were engineers, developers, designers. They were very productive in producing crops. Imagine getting 2 to 10 inches of rain a year and being able to grow crops that could feed and be exported to a lot of the places in the world at that time where they could get to with those exports, where they were needed. Amazing, amazing. We do that in the valley today. 70% of the produce in America is produced in a desert that gets 8 to 12 inches of rain a year here. They were doing that in 3000 BC. They were doing that 1,000 years before Abraham was born. Okay, so it's pretty amazing. What we think we're pretty sophisticated here in the valley and can do so much with a desert, and they were doing it long before us. I shared this a few years ago, and a guy who was grown up and lived in farming all of his life, after I got done describing what they did and how they did it, he said, "You know what? It's only been in the last 50 years that we've gone beyond where they were in 3000 BC. He said, "It's just amazing what they could do back then." But that's the area that he grew up in. Sumerians were not aggressive people. Akkadians and Elamites were, but they had to learn how to defend themselves from the Akkadians and the Elamites, because the Akkadians and Elamites sure liked to come and take the produce and the things that the Sumerians produced and invented and designed. They liked to come in by force and do that. So eventually the Sumerians had to learn how to defend themselves. And so they created an army, and we'll get into that in just a second. So on the second page, by the way, stop me anytime, ask questions. Yeah. We'll get into that.
Okay.
Yeah, good question. Good question. We'll get that in just a second, because on the next page we're going to get into the flood and all that. So the land of the Sumerians, I've talked about some of that already. One of the things that happened, this is on page 2 in your notes, the very top of the page, the land of the Sumerians. Every spring, winter and spring, they would get their rain, their annual rainfall. Both there and they were at the south end of the Tigris-Euphrates rivers. The rivers flowed down to Sumer. And so all of the rains that would come throughout Akkad to the north, even all the way up into Turkey, modern-day Turkey today, all of northern Iraq, southern Iraq, all of those rains would come, and the southern part of the Tigris-Euphrates River where Sumer was at would flood every spring, late winter, early spring, they would flood. And so they had to learn how to deal with these floods that would come every year and then the rest of the year be virtually baked dry. But how do you preserve, live on 2 to 10 inches of rain a year? How do you survive with that? How do you preserve that? And so they became masters at irrigation, dikes, canals, levees. They did all kinds of things. They had to build their architecture, their homes, their cities had to be prepared for floods. Literally, it would just overflow the banks and flood everything. Could be as much as 2 to 3 feet deep in an area where you're used to just being barren and dry 10 months out of the year. So they had to build accordingly. They had to levee, they had to build dikes, they had to build dams, they had to do all kinds of things to live under those kind of circumstances. As you read through some of the Old Testament, when you get into some of the kings, you are going to read stories about the Assyrians, for instance. It would be after the spring and they would leave and move west to conquer, and then they would get back at the end of the summer because they wanted to get, or early fall, because they wanted to get back home before the floods came. They couldn't, it was very difficult to take an army through 2 to 3 foot of water with all your supplies and everything else. So they would have to wait until after the spring rains and floods had died down, then they would go off to war. And before it started again, they had to be back home. And so you'll see all the way through the Old Testament, them leaving in the late spring and coming back in the fall. Why don't they just finish their war where they're at and finish destroy? Well, they got to get back home. Supply lines are cut off, everything. So it affected a lot of different things. If you stop and think about the land in which they live, it took everybody working together to make life work for them. And that's how a lot of the cities got started, was because people, it was easier to work together when you lived in proximity to one another. There was really no need to go out and live on farmhouses isolated, because you could get picked off pretty easy by the Akkadians and Elamites who would send war parties in. So you needed to have some kind of mass of people and some kind of protection, and cities started developing. City-states developed from there as well. They had very little, hardly any stone, very different terrain than what you will see in Israel when you're there. That area of the Middle East is all rock, basically. Everything except for Galilee, where you're going to go, is just rocks. But this was not the case. There were not very many stones in their terrain. There was not hardly any trees at all. They didn't grow. There were some, obviously, around the rivers, but in terms of out in the countryside, very few trees that would we would call, nothing like an oak tree or anything like that. They were other kinds of desert kind of trees that would be out there that would usually be shorter and spread out, but not the big blossoming trees we would. So they didn't have a lot of wood to work with. They didn't have stone to work with. So how did they build their houses? How did they live? Well, they had a lot of clay, was a lot of the dirt that they had. There's a lot of clay in it, so they became brick masons. They built almost everything out of brick. So they would grow straw, they would take the clay, they would make bricks out of it, they would bake them and then build houses out of them. Bake them by just sticking them out in the 120-degree sun and letting them dry out. But they would build everything. Nothing was more, except for their ziggurats that we'll look at in just a minute, nothing was more than two stories high, just because the brick could, as a foundation, could not bear the weight more than two stories high. So everything was sort of low. We'll get into some of the population in just a second. Let's look at the history real quick there. Before the flood, I could spend our whole time here, but I'm going to just sort of breeze through some of this, and then we can talk about it some other time if you want to. But before the flood, we have from Ur and some of the cities around Ur, we have storehouses of documents. We talk about king lists. We have over 40,000 fragments, pieces of documents that talk about their king lists, their kings, their government, that kind of thing, dating even back before the flood. They have, and we'll talk about how we know that in just a second. The king lists that we have today have been compiled into, from all those fragments, we've compiled 15 different full-length documents that have king lists. King lists were, this king reigned in this city from this date to this date. Before the flood, they reigned from, the average was probably 300 to 400 years that they would reign as king. Now, that, many archaeologists will say, well, they were exaggerating. And it's possible that they were exaggerating some. But when you consider life expectancies before the flood of being 800 to 1,000 years old, to reign as a king for 300 to 400 years was pittance. I mean, that wasn't that long. You were a well past middle-aged man by the time you became king if you only reigned for 300 or 400 years. So it was just interesting. After the flood, the king lists pick up again, and we start seeing kings that reign for 100 years, and then 80 years, and then 70 years, and the dates start going down significantly after the flood. But we have names, we have places, we have dates, we have accomplishments of those kings that are all listed. We have entire libraries that we have unearthed through archaeology in modern-day Iraq. Before all the stuff happened over there that's happening today, it was a rich environment and open for all kinds of archaeological study, and we have libraries, we have schoolhouses and school rooms still intact with their desks, with their tablets, with their books, all that stuff that we can read. We understand what they were studying, how they were studying. We'll talk about that in just a second. The king lists, when you read them, the portion of the king lists that were before the flood, all of them end abruptly with these words, "The flood swept over the earth." That's how the king lists end. And the years that it talks about, There are a couple hundred years before we see the kingless start picking up again after the flood. Yes.
So was all this recorded before the flood or after the flood?
I don't know that it was recorded before the flood on these particular documents or if it was reaccounted after the flood on these documents that we have today. I assume that's probably what it was, that it was after the flood, that they would go back. But you have to remember, everything they did was rote memory. And they were, most of their learning, education, was through rote memory. They were very proficient at doing that. So those kind of things would have been able to be recorded after the flood because Shem, Ham, Japheth, Noah all had lived before the flood and knew all of those things. And it was very easy for them to either record it or pass it on to where it could be recorded afterwards. It's interesting to think about, too, though, that if we go by the dates that are given, if the genealogical records that we have in the book of Genesis are all the records there are, and it's probably not the case, there were probably more than 14 generations in every record that we have there. And it's not because it's inaccurate, it's just because that's the way they listed things. For instance, I have a son named Brian. He has a son named Cole. I have other children too, but just for this illustration, it would not be uncommon at all for them to record Rick, the father of Cole, or Cole, the son of Rick, and then leave out my son Brian in between, simply because they considered it that way. A grandfather, a great-grandfather, a great-great-grandfather was considered the father of his grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren. They looked at it that way. So when they would record their genealogies. But if you just take the records that are there, Shem was alive, if that was all that there was, when Jacob was alive. Shem was still alive. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Probably not the case, but he probably was alive close to the life of Abraham, at least. So it's not like it was 1,000 years or something like that before Abraham would have begun to recount some of his stories or write some of those things down. The firsthand sources were there. Some of Shem's children would have been alive during the days of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, his immediate children. We need to think about how all that works out because Shem, Ham, and Japheth lived much longer, having lived pre-flood and everything. They lived much longer than those who came later on in the days of Abraham. Good question. Sorry I went off on all that so much. The flood stories, there are over 200, letter B there, there are over 200 flood stories around the world, South America to Russia. All over the world we have flood stories. All of them are very similar stories. We have a flood story from Sumer called the Gilgamesh Tablets. Tablet 2, which is basically the story of the flood as well from this particular area, in the time of Abraham. You can even go online and pop it up and look at it, read the whole thing. They have these, but it's not the only record. It's the most famous one probably. But again, there are flood stories in South America. There are flood stories in Siberia, out of Siberia, that are available. All very similar, all have their own cultural quirks, but very similar record of what happened. Many of them will even record that this took place so many years after creation, which is interesting. After Adam and Eve, or after the first man and woman were created, many of the flood stories will say this took place 1,600, 1,700 years after creation of this first man and woman, whatever their names may be in that culture. Interestingly, they're all within 100 years of each other from all over the world. So it's a fair guess that the flood took place somewhere within 1,700 years of the creation of Adam and Eve, Genesis 1 and 2, based upon these stories from all over the world that had people didn't know each other, never ran into each other, and yet they're all saying the same thing. And the flood probably took place, I'm guessing, roughly 1,200, 1,400 years before the time of Abraham, at most. It could be as little as 800 years before the time of Abraham. After the flood, the king lists pick up again. Let her see there around 3,200, 3,300 BC. Same thing in Egypt, by the way. Ham, the other son, one of the other sons of Noah, settled Egypt and what became known as Canaan and Egypt, that area that is now modern-day Lebanon, Syria, Israel, Jordan, and down into Egypt. All of that area is were descendants of Ham. Japheth would have been modern-day Turkey and west into Europe. That area, that would have been where Japheth settled, and Shem settled most of modern-day Iraq and western Iran. That's where that son settled with his family that we're looking at today. Abraham was born in 2166 B.C. That's within 1 or 2 years. We can pinpoint that based upon a lot of dates that are given in the Old Testament. And his age at certain times that we know the dates of and all of that. So he was born around 2166 B.C., There's an interesting phenomena. That little city of Ur that I talked about on the map, that was the focal point of the most dynamic part of civilization development that we have historically. It was called the Ur III dynasty. You've heard about different dynasties in Egypt. This was the Ur III dynasty. From 2100 to 1900 BC, roughly, Abraham was born at the very beginning of that. He left during the early part of that Ur dynasty. God called him to leave there. But that's what he was raised in. That's that whole culture. That is what he was a part of when he was being born and raised. There were approximately 1 million people that lived in Sumer. There were 500,000 people that lived in the southern part of Sumer, and 250,000 of those people, so 250,000 people, lived in Ur. So if 250,000 people, that's the city limits of Fresno has 500,000, roughly, 500,000 people, just a little over that. So half of the city of Fresno lived in this little dot that we looked at called Ur, which was quite a large city at that period of time. If you think about in modern day terms, how many people live in California? Anybody know? 30 million, 35 million people. Imagine a quarter of all those people living in one city. Okay, that's not hard to imagine because that's sort of what happens in the LA area. That's the equivalent of what Ur was in that day. It would have been the modern day Los Angeles area, not just the city, but the area. Does that make sense? So, the culture of the Sumerians. This is where I like to spend a little bit more time. This is during that Ur III dynasty that Abraham was born and raised in and then left early on in. Talk about the culture, letter A, the education. It was common and widespread. And it was not just tutors and mentors that we may think of. They had a formal educational system, very similar in some ways to the early educational system in America, where you would have schoolhouses and you would have a teacher that would be hired by the people of the community to teach their children. That's very similar to what happened here. Families would get together and they would hire a teacher. Most class sizes were anywhere from 10 to 30 students. The average class would have been around 15. 30 was really large, but most of them had about 15 students, had one professor, they called him, this person was being paid by the parents of these children to educate their children in a wide variety of subjects that we're going to look at. If it was not like our modern day educational system, but like early on. If the students were not being educated or the families did not like the quality of education, they would fire the professor and hire somebody else. So as a professor, your livelihood depended upon how well you performed, how well you were training these students, not upon their grades, but about how much they were learning. And if they weren't learning up to the standards that the parents had for you, you got fired and you got replaced by somebody else who would do that and could do that. So it was a very, I'm saying all of that, not to compare it to today, but I'm saying that because it created an atmosphere of a very strict classroom. The professor was determined you were going to learn one way or another and put systems in place that guaranteed you were going to learn or else, because he didn't want to lose his job. And so it was very strict, very stern, very legalistic, very high control kind of a classroom setting. Classes started at sunup and they went to sundown, 12 months a year. Okay? There were no big holidays and summer breaks and that sort of thing. They went 12 months out of the year, sun up to sundown, until they were in their early teens, and then they went into something else for at least 2 years that we'll talk about in a second. That was very common. But they had classrooms, they had text, they had courses they studied. Okay, number two on the next page, the school father or the professor. We've talked a little bit about him. He was responsible for the curriculum. He was responsible for the students' learning. He was paid for by the parents. He the students, number three, were called the school sons. Sorry, ladies, but it was only the boys that were educated in that day. That's just the way it was. We still have, I told you, we've unearthed classrooms where they studied. We still have some of the names of some of the rosters, some of the roles of the students' names from that day. So we know exactly how long big the class size was. We know what their names were. We know who if there were family members in there together. We know all that kind of stuff. But we have some of that kind of stuff. But the students were called sons, school sons. Then there was, number four, a big brother. It's usually an older student who had been under this professor for a period of time. And this big brother or assistant professor would do things to help the professor with their curriculum. They used clay tablets. Remember, they didn't have paper to write on because they didn't have many trees and they couldn't produce that. They didn't have the kind of things you needed to produce that, but they had clay tablets. And he would prepare fresh clay tablets so when the school sons came into class that day, they would have fresh clay tablets, soft clay that they could practice on. He would have things on a clay tablet for them to look at and to copy. So he would do a lot of the preparation. He would do a lot of the going from student to student to make sure they were doing things right and correct them if they were not. He would be the one they would have to, they had to memorize a lot of things, and he would be the one they would have to go and recite those things by memory to. So we had that. They had an art teacher. We won't go into that. They had a grammar teacher as well, someone who would come in and assist the professor in these particular areas. Not every schoolhouse, every time, from what we can tell, had an art teacher and a grammar teacher, but we know that some of them did. We have records of those things as well. That would be a separate person who would come in and teach art, teach grammar. They had grammar texts. They were different than our books today. Again, you're dealing with clay documents, so you don't bind them together and put them together like you do today. But there were these clay documents would be put together, and they would go through them in order to learn certain things, these hardened clay documents. And then number seven there was one who was in charge of the whip. You can guess what that person was responsible for. It was all the discipline that needed to take place. And I think the title is pretty descriptive of how they carried out physical discipline, was with a whip. So you just get the idea. It was a little bit different than our classroom setting today. There was a lot of, you're going to learn, whether you want to learn or not, you're here to learn. There's a guy over here with a whip that's going to make sure that you stay in line, that you do what you're told to do, that you're on task, etc. So it was very regimented, that kind of an atmosphere. That's what Abraham grew up in. Abraham grew up in that kind of a setting as a young man. He had to learn. It was very strict, no question about it. And the educational expectations were extremely high. Now, let's look just briefly. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but the cuneiform writing, how did they write? They wrote things. They had documents they had written, like I said, over 1,000 years before Abraham, that we have these, and seemingly before that they even had these things. But we know 1,000 years at least before Abraham, they had this. They started off with what was called pictograph. The name of it gives you some idea to where they were like pictures. They would draw things using pictures. Those pictographs became what was known as cuneiform writing, it was sort of a shorthand way of doing pictograph. We're going to look at it and just give you some samples of that in just a second. But cuneiform writing was the birthplace of hieroglyphics, the birthplace of Hebrew writing, lettering. And you're going to look at it in just a second, you're going to say, boy, that looks a lot like Chinese letters. A lot of that, those kind of languages or written forms came out of this cuneiform writing. Cuneiform was simply a script used by many of these ancient languages, and they would take it and adapt it to their culture, to them, where they lived. Look at the next page, and I'll give you an idea of what I'm talking about. On the top up there in that picture, you'll see a clay tablet in the hand of this person. It's 2 inches wide by 3 inches long, roughly. You can see it's not real thick, but it's not real thin either. It's got to be something that's thick enough that you can press into it, that you can hold it in your hand, and it's not going to be too flimsy. It's something that when it dries, if it's not thick enough, it's going to crack and crumble. It's got to be thick enough that when it dries, it doesn't do that. So you can get a picture of what it was like. And we've got tens of thousands of these documents. From Sumer. Not from all over the world, from Sumer, down in that area. The little stick that he has is a stylus. And the stylus has two ends to it. There is the small end and the larger end. Right now, he's using the larger end, and it will make those long, thin triangle shapes. It's that sort of thing. The other one is much thinner, and you can make smaller kind of shapes, triangle shapes, or straighter kind of lines with the smaller end, or even dots. But you can see that's cuneiform writing. You can see how it still resembles pictures, but it's gone beyond that now. And they could write, their language was this way. Now you look at that little piece of 2 inch by 3 inch clay. How do you mass produce those? So if the big brother, the sort of the assistant to the professor, came in and wanted to prepare 15 copies of the same document for all of them, all the students to read that day at the professor's orders, did he have to go through and make all 15 of those? No. What he and the professor would have done is create these small, 3 inch high, narrow, very small in diameter, stone cylinders. And they would carve out so that the lettering stood up high, and they would carve out around it. Then they would take and wrap that 2 inch by 3 inch piece of clay around it, press it on there, unroll it off, put it down, and let it dry. First printing press, first copy machine, way back then. But you will hear and read occasionally, potentially, about these stone cylinders that they would find or use. We think of these people as being primitive. This was going on 5,000 years ago. 5,000 years ago, this was going on. Whether you believe in evolution or not, most of our minds have been conditioned to think about people who lived a long time ago were very primitive, who weren't really that bright, were just trying to figure out what's light, what's dark, what's fire, living in caves. We think about them that way. And I want to suggest to you, think back, if the Bible is correct, as I believe it is, about the creation of Adam and Eve, they were created with minds just like our minds, that were not polluted, that were not perverted. They'll tell us today that a really average person will use about 5% of their brain capacity. 5%. Why? Well, we're so limited by the things around us. We don't even think about going beyond that. We have so many limitations. What if we didn't? Like Adam and Eve, who didn't have all the limitations, all the scarring, all the stuff that we deal with today. What if they didn't have that? Pretty intelligent people, pretty capable. In fact, we're going to look at stuff right now that was going on 5,000 years ago that is still being taught in classrooms in America today. Okay? You use the things that the Sumerians started every day. How many of you have a watch that tells time or a phone that tells time? You can thank the Sumerians for time as we know it and the telling of time as we know it. Let's get into that. Let's look at that. So the significance on the top of the next page was that Abraham was an educated man. What was he educated in? Let's look at that. He was educated in literature. This would have been very common in his day in these schoolhouses. I mentioned poetry for educational purposes. What is the value of poetry in education? Sure. That's good. What else?
Culture, too.
Okay. Cultural.
Memorizing.
When you think about young students and their only way of learning was rote memory. Now, that was their way of thinking about education. Education is how much we can cram into your brain and you can remember. Okay. Think about this. In Jesus' day, even in modern day, my Hebrew professor in seminary, after he finished his master's and doctor's degree at Harvard in Hebrew literature, spent a year living with a rabbi and his family in Israel. And every day, the rabbi and he would go for a walk. This was 50 years ago at the most. They would go for a walk every morning for 3 hours. And the rabbi would begin quoting from somewhere in the Old Testament in Hebrew. No Bible. He wasn't reading. He was quoting. This is 3 hours every morning. 6 days a week, they would do this. And he would just randomly begin quoting somewhere, and he would quote for 30, 40 minutes. And then he would stop, and he would look at my professor, and my professor had to pick up where he left off, wherever it was, and begin quoting. And they did that for 3 hours back and forth, every day, 6 days a week. 3 hours a morning. They would do that. That was 50 years ago. I can't even imagine doing that, but that's the way their minds worked. That's what they did. And poetry was, besides all the other things that it did, that was one of the values of poetry. It facilitated memory, the poetry did. They could remember things. Your Bible is written, you think about all of the poetry. The book of Job, most of the book of Job is poetry. The Psalms, the Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, the book of Lamentations. You're looking at a lot of poetry in your Bible as well. Even in the historical books that you're going to read, there are large sections of it at times that'll be written in poetry form, where they, if there's a song that somebody sings, it's written poetically to go along with that song that was sung. So it's very important. They used acrostics as well as part of their poetry, which is open up your Bible to Psalm 119. What is Psalm 119 known for mostly? Huh? Yeah, it's the longest chapter in the Bible. What is the primary subject of Psalm 119? I'm sorry?
The Word of God.
Yeah, the Word of God. If you will notice, I don't know how yours is broken up, but I guarantee you, it's probably broken up into groups of 8 verses. Is that true? Okay. The beginning of every 8 verses is the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Okay. So it's written in this acrostic form so it can be memorized more easily. We even as little will teach little little children. Their ABCs with a song. We have a lot of children's songs that we want them to memorize certain things. Even in Christianity, VeggieTales and those kind of things have made a whole industry around teaching catchy tunes that children can sing and learn about children's stories from the Bible, or stories from the Bible for children. Why do they do that? So they can remember it. Acrostics are very popular in their literature, as some of their poetry, same way in your Bible. 8 different psalms in the book of Psalms are strictly acrostics, where either every verse starts with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet, or in this case, sections of 8 verses. Mine even starts off at the top of, it's not part of the original Hebrew text, but the headings for my 8 verses are the next Hebrew letter in the alphabet, because that is clearly how it's broken out. Very similar, you would see a lot of acrostic poetry in their literature as well. A lot of proverbs like we have as well, a lot of histories. They were very big on remembering the history of things. So a lot of histories, which is very valuable to us nowadays to be able to look back and see how long it was from here to here, how long a certain person lived, the things they accomplished, all of that. Religious stories were very popular. Essays, they wrote a lot of political essays. Records of kings and how long they reigned and what their achievements were. They wrote the first farmers, what we would call the Farmer's Almanac. What you needed to know of when things were going to happen. When are the rains going to start this year? Based upon their histories, they didn't know the weather patterns and how to gauge a lot of that from around the world. They didn't have satellites to look and forecast things, but they had history. So they knew what day of the year for the last 1,000 years it had started raining and what the patterns were for the last 1,000 years of the rainy seasons and how they tended to go in cycles and that sort of thing. So they would tell you, here's when the day it's going to start raining this year. And they would be mostly accurate. They would be just about as accurate as our weathermen are today anyway, however accurate that is. But they would be able to tell you. They would be able to tell you all kinds of things. There were all kinds of things in these farmers' almanacs about everything from medical treatments. If you get this kind of medical problem, here's what you can do to deal with it. If you're farming, here are the ways you can plow certain kinds of fields. Here are certain things you need to do. Here's how you build dikes. Here's how you build cisterns to collect water. Here's how you build dams. Here's how you build canals and feed your fields, your crops with the canals. Here's the how often you need to water if the temperature is this high for this many days. All of those kinds of things. It was a how-to guide to survive in their culture. Now, think about this for just a second. Poetry and Proverbs. Do we have any of that in our modern-day Bible? Yes. Histories and religious stories. Do we have any of that in our Bible? Yes. Do we have essays about things that are given? Yes. Do we have how-to books? Think about the book of Leviticus when you get there. Think about that from this vantage point of how do you survive in this culture? What do you eat? What do you not eat? How do you live your daily life? What are certain routines you need to have? To make life work. We see these same kinds of literature pieces in our Bible today, going all the way back, very similar to the culture that Abraham came out of. Now then, that's literature. Look at mathematics. This is where it gets fun. Mathematics and science. square roots. Everybody knows what a square root is. The Sumerians are the ones who first taught square roots to students. You still study those square roots today in classrooms. If you're a teacher, you teach them in your classroom. Abraham not only was taught, but taught square roots to his children. He taught Isaac about square roots. Geometry, basic geometry. We've taken it further than when it went there, but geometry, both geometry and trigonometry were both, the roots of those go all the way back to Sumeria. So they know how to figure distances, angles. They know how to find the center of a circle. They knew how to do all of those kinds of things, and they taught them in school to children in that day. The sexagesimal system, the next, number three there. This is the most fascinating thing in the world to me. They had a fascination with the number six. Okay? I have a question for you. How many seconds in a minute? 60. How many minutes in an hour? How many hours in a day? On and on and on. Minutes. How many inches in a foot? The way we tell time today, the way we measure things, go back 5,000 years ago to the Sumerians. We still do it today. Did you ever go through school and say, why 12s? Why 6s? Why not 10s? It's so much easier to go with the metric system, isn't it? If you just stop and think about it from a pure addition, multiplication, division vantage point, it's so much easier to but why do we insist upon 12s and 6s around everything? It goes all the way back to there. They had the same thing back then that we have now. They measured things, they timed things. The way we do today, we do it measured based upon what they did back then. Why in the Jewish calendar, until well after the time of Christ, the Jewish calendar was based upon 12 months made up of 30 days each month for a calendar of 360 days in the year. Now, there's more than that. The Jews knew that there were more days than a year in a lunar year than that, but it was 360 days, and every few years, they would have a holiday and use up those days and then start over again. Okay? Because they had built up 4.5 days every year, and then they would just take a holiday, and then they would start over again to catch up. Does that make sense? But that's what they did. Geometry. How many degrees in a circle? Interesting. All of that goes back to this. Okay? They are the ones who invented all of that. They are the roots of the dating system, the calendaring that we do today. You can look back and you say, yes, but the Romans created the modern day calendar and all that. Where did the Romans get the idea for 12 months in a year? That roughly average out to 30 days in a month. They changed the number of days in a month and all that, but they still have 12 months. They all are around 30 days. Goes all the way back. The Romans gave the modern day names to our months, but they didn't invent the calendar with 12 months in it. Yeah. What they did was the Romans accounted for the 365 days and a quarter that we have in a year by changing the number of days in the months a little bit. Even then, they got sort of weird. Why February 28 and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And other months, 31 days. So I don't know. I've never looked into that much. Let's look at some other subjects on page 6 there. But these are subjects that Abraham studied in school growing up as a boy. How to grow crops. Whole agronomy, all of that. They studied botany. You might just write down there Genesis chapter 21. I think it's like verse 32, the end of that chapter, near the end of it. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, which is about 20 miles west of Arad down in the southern desert, where you're going to go when you go to Israel. Arad is a famous city. A second temple was built in Arad, just 20 miles east of Beersheba, and you will have the opportunity to see a tamarisk tree that was planted a long, long, long time ago. How did Abraham know to plant a tamarisk tree, name by name, botanically, in a desert, and that it would grow? Because he studied all that. He knew what kinds of things grew best in what kind of terrain. He knew what kind of terrain it took for crops. he knew what kind of terrain a rocky desert would grow that got virtually no rain. And it would grow and last for a long, long time. You'll learn more about that when you go over there. You'll have an opportunity to see. When you go to Arad, right on the in the city limits and inside the walls of Arad, there's a tamarisk tree. You'll get a chance to see. Zoology, the raising of herds and taking care of cattle. Abraham, when he leaves Ur of the Chaldees, he has a large herd of cattle and sheep with him that he takes along with camels and other things. He has all these. How do you take care of those things? Well, he learned a lot about animal husbandry and how to do all of that in school. Mineralogy, geography. Why did Abraham, when he left Ur of the Chaldees, why did he go north up to Haran and then down into Canaan, to where he did, to modern-day Israel, to modern-day Jerusalem? Why did he go that direction? It was the Fertile Crescent. He knew geography. He knew that's where the water was. He followed the Euphrates River up into Turkey, into the area of Haran, where his uncle and his uncle's family lived. And then, when his father died, then he went down, following what was then known as the Fertile Crescent, that fertile area where he could take care of his cattle, take care of his wife and father and nephew and all of the people who were with him. Pottery making, they studied theology in school. We'll talk a little bit about that in a second. Two more things. I don't think they're in your notes there, but just let me add a number 7. They studied astronomy. By the way, this is the area that many years later you're going to see Daniel taken to. It's also the area many years later after that that the wise men came from following a star. Okay? They were wise men from the east. This is the area they came from. They studied astronomy. They studied the stars, the constellations that we give the bear and all these different names to. They knew all that stuff. They called them those things. We call them what they called them today. They knew the movements of the stars. How even when America was being discovered, how did they know how to take their ships and go west and to stay in the right direction that they wanted to go? And they used instruments that helped them measure the movement of the stars and their relationship to each other so that they would know where they were at and which direction they needed to go. All of that was a study that went all the way back to the Sumerians. They were students of the stars. They knew the consistency of the stars, and they studied them. There's a number 8 as well. They studied warfare and military tactics. They studied the art of war, not because they were a warring people. The Sumerians were not, but again, I told you the Akkadians and the Elamites were. Their neighbors to the north and to the east were very warrior-oriented. Very militant, and the Sumerians had to learn how to protect themselves. So when you got to be a teenager, roughly, you went into military service for at least 2 years. And do you, while you were in school, you studied military science, military tactics, how to use military weapons, how to build and craft military weapons for that day, and how to use them, how to train other people to use them as well, how to regiment an army. They learned all those things. So when Abraham's nephew, Lot, and his family and the people of Sodom and Gomorrah are taken captive by kings from the east, those are people mainly from Arabia. Abraham takes his servants, at most probably 100 people, and he takes them and goes and defeats 4 kings and their armies. Because Abraham came from Ur, which was a sophisticated area of education that studied military science, that didn't just practice bully politics and bully military things, thinking by force we're going to, and sheer numbers, we can defeat anyone. No, he studied military science. How to go into war, how to train people, how to defeat a larger enemy. He studied all of those things. And he practiced them as a person who served in the military in Sumer. Okay? Okay. Religion. They were polytheists. This you will see when you get to Joshua 24. You're not there yet, but you will get to Joshua 24. And Joshua said to all the people, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods." Abraham grew up in a culture that was polytheistic. They had national gods, Sumerian gods. They had city gods, and they had individual gods that they were worshiping. And all of that was encouraged. The more gods that you have that you are worshiping, the better things are going to go. This was something that had developed over time in that area. It's something that develops in the Old Testament continually. It's something that even in the height of Israel's history, during the days of Solomon, was still going on. The influence of polytheism, believing in many gods. So if I worship the sun god, maybe the sun god will give us sun at the right time and give us our crops in a better way and all of that. If I worship this fertility god, then we'll be able to have more children. Then the crops will grow and be fertile, the cattle will be fertile and multiply, and things will be good. So having more gods to worship and worshiping them was something they believed was going to make life work better for them. It's out of this, during Ur 3 and that rise of that cultural high point in Mesopotamian history, out of which so much culture for the world even today developed, it also developed a high degree of polytheism. And it's out of that that God called Abraham and said, "I want you to go to a different place. I want you to go somewhere else." And he takes him out of there and takes him to another place, and he starts a new nation through Abraham. And that's what he promised to do for him and everything. You'll see on the next page, religious temples. This is a ziggurat. This is a depiction of the ziggurat that is still found in Ur that dates back to the time before Abraham. We have the base of it. What does it remind you of in that part of the world a little bit? not that part of the world exact, but think about the pyramids in Egypt. Just to the west of this area, southwest of there. But they have stone that they're able to use. This people did not. So this is all built out of clay brick. Okay? And it is solid because it had to be. This sat in the middle of the city. For instance, this is the replica of the one in Ur, restructuring what is still there. It sat in the middle of the city. In the base of it was the city library. So that largest section there underneath was the inside of that was the city library. When you get to the top, you have this throne room that is up there, but there's nobody who ever sat in the throne room. It was just a throne room. Right down next to that, Isaiah 14, verses 13 and 14. Satan, in his rebellion against God, when he was the highest of all the angels, said, I will build my throne above the throne of God. Here is the tallest structure in every city was the ziggurat, and on top of the ziggurat, the tallest structure in every one of them was a throne room that sat empty. Isaiah 14, verses 13 and 14, really 12 through 14. Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 14. The Tower of Babel was built just north of here in the days after the flood as well, trying to build up into the clouds, I believe, a throne room for Satan to sit on. And God comes down and confounds their languages, separates the nations. They're on the wrong path. And you can see how that was continuing, even though they broke up into different nations, that was continuing during the days of Abraham when he was growing up. They had state gods, they had personal gods. I've talked about all that. During Ur 3, one other thing was introduced for the first time, and that was king worship, to worship the king. And again, this is the culture out of which Abraham is called. The cultural infrastructure, there were religious states. These were religious states, Ur was. The king was usually the political and the religious leader. But now then, this king not only was the religious leader, he referred to himself as a god that people ought to worship. There were city-states on that map. All of those cities that you saw, Ur, Uruk, Larsa, Kish, Eridu, Shurippak, all of those were city-states. They each had their own king. During Ur 3, all of those cities in southern Sumer were united under one king. And that was that 500,000 people. That southern Sumer, all of those cities, city-states, they all had their kings, but there was one king over all of them. And he reigned and ruled out of Ur, where Abraham was from. Warfare, we've talked about. Populations, we've talked about. There would have been about 1 million people that lived in modern-day Iraq. Half of them lived in Sumer. A quarter of them lived there in Ur, the city itself. Okay? City life. The city of Ur and most of the cities of that day in that valley had walls built around the city. There would be a roughly 25,000 people who would live inside the city walls. Others had to live outside the city walls. the city walls would be as much as, 77 inches thick. So they would be quite thick. They would be over, they'd be 6.5 feet thick, clay, brick walls that had been built. They would be basically built up sort of like this. They served not only as a protection in times of war, but they also served as a way of keeping the water out during the rainy season. You would go into the city, you would not walk into in a street with a gate. You would have to go up and over a 4 to 5 foot embankment to get into the city gate. Again, because of the rainy season and the floods that would come, etc. They all lived in houses, each family. They did not live in, their houses were anywhere from 2,000 to 2,500 square feet. They, almost all of them were two-story, and they were one family. They had streets. Each piece of property with this house in it would have walls that would be two stories high as well. That would be part of the house. So you would have a wall, and that would serve as not only part of your house, but part of a wall for a street. The streets would be wide enough for an ox cart. They were 4 to 5 feet wide at the most. They were one way. You could only go certain ways. They had one-way streets because you couldn't take an ox cart down one way and have another one coming the other way because they were only big enough for one. So you had one-way streets in this large 250,000 people living in this area, 25,000 inside the walls, but the city was way beyond the walls. And so they lived in these houses, single-family residences predominantly. No apartment kind of buildings like you would see in Rome and all of that. Marriage and family, let me get into that real quick. Family was very important. Part of their law was, at near the very top of their law books, repeatedly from this period, was this: be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Sound familiar? Going all the way back to Genesis chapter 1 and the command that was given to Adam and Eve, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And they took that seriously. And so they had laws underneath that that talked about if you are not able to have children, for instance, if your wife is not able to have children, she is responsible for providing you as a husband with someone who will be able to bear children for you. And you are responsible for having sons so that you can maintain the seed line and keep passing on and growing and multiplying in the future. So when Sarah takes her handmaid and gives her to Abraham, and Abraham says, okay, I'm going to do this, and you scratch your head and say, boy, how God doesn't want you to do that. Well, that was their culture. It doesn't make it right, but it makes it understandable why that's something she would think of. I mean, I don't see too many women today in our culture, when they can't have a baby, naturally think of, let's see, who can I go get for my husband? Now, I mean, we just don't even go there. And so it seems strange that she would go there, but not in their culture. Because in their culture, it was illegal from where she was born and raised and had been for over 1,000 years. It was illegal for her not to do that. It was not cultural. It was not legal for her to not do that. And so it was very, makes a lot of sense why she would do it. Whether it's right or wrong is another issue, but it makes a lot of sense why she would do it and why Abraham would go along with it. Families were very large because of that as well. We've talked a lot about agriculture, calendaring. There were a lot of different occupations that you can imagine. Let's look at the last page and we'll wrap up. I wasn't going to be able to get into all this other anyway. Just look at number 7 on page 10. This will take about a minute, and we'll be done. All of these things are addressed in their literature. We have literature from Sumer from the time of Abraham or even before for all of these subjects. Creation. We have a creation story in print from the time of Abraham or before. Very similar to Genesis 1 and 2. Genealogies prior to the flood. We have those in Genesis 4 and 5. We have them in documents from Sumer, from the time of Abraham or before. Noah and his sons in the flood. We have the Gilgamesh tablets talking about the flood and the people involved in it and who came out of it. Same thing that we have in Genesis 6 through 9. Different names. The story is different. But I believe that what part of the reason God took Abraham out of Sumer and said, I want you to go somewhere else, is I want you to get out of this place where the stories are being diluted. And I want you to go someplace where the stories can, where it can be pure and be preserved and not get diluted. Genealogies after the flood, we see the king lists that are, well, I talked about in Sumer after the flood. We have those same kinds of things in Genesis chapter 10. We see that same kind of genealogy. We see it in chapter 46, chapter 50 of Genesis as well. The dispersion of the nations. We have texts in Sumer talking about how the nations were dispersed, just like we see in Genesis 11, that same kind of story. The genealogy of Shem in Sumer. His name in Genesis is Shumar. Instead of Sumer, to that area that he went to and started that. But we see that in Genesis chapter 10. This is where Abraham came from. This is what he experienced. This is what he brought with him. These are the roots of the culture that we see in the book of Genesis all the way through the Old Testament. These are the roots of that culture. Did you study at the end of Abraham's life? Have you gotten there? You've talked about the death of Sarah. Have you gotten beyond that yet? Notice when you get there, Abraham remarried. We don't often hear about that. Had children, but before he died, he sent all of his children and their families away to the east, where he came from. Okay? So he has other children. He sends them away back to Ur, back to that area, back to the east where he had come from. Uh-huh.
I was actually reading that last night because I was wanting to review Genesis before I got here today. It said in the commentary that it was common for only wealthy men to have concubines.
Well, in the days of Abraham, again, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth is the mindset he grew up with. And so Sarah is dead, but he is still able to produce children. And that was very important and culturally to them. I'll let Mike deal with David and Solomon and all those with you, okay? You ask that question when you get there. That's good. Because I'm past time. I got to quit. Let me pray and get you out of here. Father, thanks so much for just the privilege, the icing on the cake, to be able to see things today that were going on 5,000 years ago from their own hand, from their own literature, from their own culture that we've unearthed today. Thank you for letting us get an insight into that so we can understand your Bible just a little bit better. Pray that you would help us remember some of these things and open our eyes to some of the reasons why things happen the way they do in the Old Testament. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. Good to be with you guys. Good to see you.